This is the Hip Hop African Podcast, a show where we have in-depth conversations about African hip-hop culture and artists. Your host is Msia Kibona Clark, a professor in the Department of African Studies at Howard University. For more information or to contact us, please visit us at hiphopafrican.com.
Welcome back to the Hip Hop African Podcast. In today's episode, we sit down with one of South Africa's hip hop pioneers, DJ Ready D. Since playing an important part in helping to build Cape Town's early hip hop community, Ready D has been involved in the culture's evolution for more than four decades. He reflects on hip hop's role during apartheid, the rise of Prophets of the City, his journey as a world-class turntablist, and his long-standing commitment to youth development and community uplift. This is a powerful conversation with a hip-hop pioneer whose story is deeply intertwined with the history of South African hip-hop. Let's get into the episode.
So I've read some of the stuff from interviews that you've done. One of the questions I heard asked or saw that you talked about was Rapper's Delight being like your introduction to hip-hop. And so really I wanted to know, what was it that you saw or heard in that music that attracted you, and in what ways did you identify with what you saw and heard?
Sure, Rapper's Delight was the first hip-hop song that I was introduced to. The reason why I was attracted to the song, number one, I could relate to the music because they used the music from this band called Chic, which was a disco band from the 70s. And my father used to have that music in his collection, and I thought it was very interesting. And the fact that I heard these guys rhyming words, I could relate to that as well, because as a kid growing up, we used to speak in some sort of rhyme form as well. And a lot of the humor also used to come across in a rhyme form as well. So those were the things that made me relate. And a lot of the stuff that the guys were saying in the song was all aspirational. They were talking about color TVs and swimming pools. And those are the things that we could only have dreamt of, you know, at that time and at that point in your life as well. So there was a lot of aspiration that came across, and there was it was such a feel-good song that drew me in. And at the later stage, when we were exposed to more hip-hop music, it drew me in even further. So that was just what I heard. And I think what made it really cool, to a certain degree, it's kind of like an oxymoron to a certain degree. When I was introduced to Rapper's Delight, we were still living in District 6. And we had a few more months to go before we were officially kicked out of the area due to the previous Apartheid Group Areas Act law that they had. And my father just passed away as well. And the music was brought to our home by a group of my sister's friends. And it's very interesting because these guys had a white and red Chevy Impala. I think they had a 63 Impala. And they had a batch of these records that they pulled out of the boot of that car and a little portable turntable. So for a young kid that always grew up around music, and for somebody that grew up around hi-fi systems and all these things, of course that's going to excite me. And I was very excited to hear the music. I didn't quite understand what it was. I didn't know it was hip-hop music either, you know. So we were into the music and into the culture probably for about 3 years before we actually came to realize this thing that we are busy with here. It's actually called hip-hop, and it is connected to our culture.
Wow. And so speaking of District 6, because I did read that was when you first started hearing hip-hop, you were still living in District 6. And, you know, we know that period of forced removals, I was reading that 60,000 residents were displaced from District 6 and forced to move into townships. So how did that impact, that moving, the trauma, that experience, impact your relationship with hip-hop?
I think the move from District 6 into Mitchell's Plain somehow strengthened my relationship with hip-hop music and the culture. Because at the same time as Rapper's Delight came along, shortly after that, I was then exposed to Curtis Blow's The Breaks. And when we moved into Mitchell's Plain, there was a friend of mine whose parents owned a video machine with a recorder, and he used to record all these videos on television. And in these videos, there were kids breaking, you know, and I was blown away by that as well, because we were exposed to kung fu movies as kids growing up. So all the acrobatics and all the crazy things, we used to mimic those things as kids as well. So in my head, when I saw breaking for the first time in a music video by Malcolm McLaren called Buffalo Girls, I thought it was a new form of gymnastics combined with kung fu done to this very interesting music. And still, I did not know it was a part of hip-hop music and culture. And it just drew us in further as well, you know. So I think it strengthened the relationship. I would say the consciousness and the activism aspects of the culture and the music, all of that developed much later.
And I assume that you all weren't necessarily aware of the forced removals that were happening in the South Bronx with the people, which very similar to what was happening here. To build the Cross Bronx Expressway, people were displaced and forced to move, and it really disrupted the community. Were you, I'm assuming you weren't aware of it at the time, but were you kind of later able to see some of the parallels in like hip hop's response to the traumas of those things here, as well as hip hop's response to it in New York?
We started connecting the dots and drawing the parallels probably around about 1985-86, when hip hop started to move into a consciousness space. So we were introduced to Afrika Mambaata and the Zulu Nation. We started to learn about the Nation of Islam as well. At the time that I was introduced to the music and the culture, we didn't know what was going on in the States, because the music just, the music that we listened to was all happy-go-lucky music. There was breaking, b-boying, scratching. There was no messages coming through. And I know the message by Grandmaster Malamala and Grandmaster Flash, we were exposed to that much later as well. So after hearing those lyrics, we could relate, because the things that he was talking about in that song is exactly what we experienced, you know, on our side of the world as well. And I think those are all the aspects that kind of made things a little bit more concrete in terms of our relationship, and also the being further attracted and drawn into the culture as well. So with 1984 moving into 1986, the political climate in our country started to intensify. And I think with hip-hop taking a black conscious route, or consciousness, or a pro-African, a pro-black route, that also made us gravitate towards it even more. Because, you know, when NWA dropped Fuck the Police, that became our anthem back here in Cape Town City. Because that's exactly how we felt. You know, we were met with the state of emergencies. We were met with the roadblocks. We were harassed by the military forces. We had guns stuck in our faces. We were abused by these guys. So, you know, we could really relate to that. And when the Nation of Islam came along, through groups such as Public Enemy and X-Clan came along, and Poor Righteous Teachers came along with the 5%ers messages, we could relate to all of those things, you know, because it's like they were speaking directly to us. And we reached a point of like, wow, these guys and these ladies from the U.S., they are all celebrating being African, but we're right here in Africa with a fight on our hands. So we might as well celebrate and elevate who we are as Africans. And then we started the African hip-hop movement out here in Cape Town City. And that's sort of how our connection and how the interest started to broaden as well, in terms of understanding our political and our social dynamic more as well as young kids. And also remember, at that time, we didn't receive the information because it was cultural boycotts in South Africa, the information coming from abroad. So a lot of what we have received have come in through drips and drabs, and maybe on cassettes, and information being smuggled into the country. And it was the same with the music as well.
Speaking of that, in terms of the consciousness in hip-hop in the U.S., between 1985 and 1990, there were at least 5 or 6 songs released in the U.S. by hip-hop artists speaking out against apartheid.
Yes.
And again, being someone who's of that generation, like, I remember not going to BP because BP was in South Africa. I remember the days of, you know, protests in front of the South African embassy. I remember Chris Hani came to my city and did a talk. And it was very interesting not knowing what the youth here were going through, because then we didn't know hip hop was happening here. So being a teenager, listening to these songs, singing these songs, and like speaking out against apartheid, we had no awareness of what youth here were doing. But it's been interesting to kind of reflect on those years and realize that you had hip hop youth speaking out against apartheid in the States, as well as hip hop youth who were in the thick of it speaking out against apartheid. And so did you, those songs that came out, did you hear them? Were you guys able to hear them or hear about them at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we were exposed to quite a lot of that music, everything, you know, in terms of the groups that I've just mentioned right now, all the conscious groups from that time and that era as well, right through to the Flavor Unit, you name it. more of the militant groups, artists such as Paris from Oakland as well. I mean, he was very, very opinionated, you know, about his stance on black consciousness and what was going on in the US and all of those things we could relate to because we are experiencing it in real time as they are talking about it, you know, and a lot of them made reference of what happened in the past. So all of those things that happened during the time of Malcolm X and all of those, we are experiencing it in real time over here. And with regards to, I would say, other territories and countries and neighboring countries and places around the world, the reason why they would not have known about South African youth, specifically Cape Town youth, using hip-hop as a means to protest is because white people control the media. So everything that went out of the country at that time, you know, it was all controlled as well. And at that time, we did not have the internet. We didn't have the technology that we have access to right now, you know, in order to broadcast information and news. And I think that's probably one of the biggest differences between then and now and how information flows.
And it's also interesting when you look at the people who were leading the protests or leading the movements, whether it be the ANC or like in the US, the NAACP, as youth, they really weren't wanting, they didn't want to listen to us. They didn't want to listen to our music. And so we heard about people like Hugh Masekela, Miriam Makeba, but it was a certain generation and it was considered acceptable and respectable, whereas hip hop wasn't. So I'm wondering here also, was there that issue where those who were leading the movement didn't want to necessarily kind of embrace hip hop and embrace the youth because of those stigmas?
Hip hop was misunderstood. Remember, we're the first generation, so nobody was properly introduced to this music, and people watched their kids transform in front of their eyes. Parents were confused. My parents were confused. It's like, look what my child is doing. How could you be spinning on your head upside down? What is going on with you? So the look, the swagger, you know, the lingo, the talk, the dialect, everything started to evolve. How we behave, you know, it affected behavior change in a big way as well. You know, and I think we were the first generation that started of unloading a lot of baggage as well. That was a foreign concept for so many people. And during that time, a lot of people also associated hip hop with being an American thing as well. So there was a lot of resistance from so many people because they didn't see it as a global, universal movement. And I could understand why as well, you know, and your priorities are elsewhere as well. So for us as a hip hop community and for kids pushing on that end, we had our own things that we needed to deal with. We weren't organized. It was just a natural reaction and a natural thing to say. And we had a lot to learn. We had a lot to discover, although we were unpacking and discovering quite a lot through the culture, but nothing was perfect in a certain sense because the access to information and still trying to understand who we are, you know, how do we fit into the grand scheme of things? All of those things was all part of the discovery for us as well.
Yeah. Speaking of, like, when you mentioned Fuck the Police, I remember that song. I remember, like, hearing it played in car radios throughout the city. Like, you go to certain neighborhoods and, you know, guys would be playing that song. For us, it was like, again, this revolutionary statement. So while our parents were protesting against police violence, speaking out against police violence, they couldn't get with the song.
I could understand. No. It's too vulgar. It's too vulgar for them. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, it was very interesting.
Yeah, so it was Fuck the Police was the anthem, and then Public Enemies Fight the Power as well. And then there was an acid house remix that came in from the UK that was titled Free Mandela. It was a dance song. It wasn't a hip-hop song. So those were kind of the anthems of the era, if you want to call it that. And the hip-hop and the culture, and at its core, it only lived in certain spaces as well, you know, because it wasn't commercial at the time as well. I mean, in our heads and the way that we saw it, it was the biggest thing in our universe. But a lot of people had yet to learn to understand it, accept it, and try and figure out what are these kids on. And a lot of people thought it was going to be a phase or a fad. You know, it's just kids going through things. It's okay. Let them break dance their hearts out. Don't worry. Tomorrow they will be back in mosque and church and they'll be dressing normal again and talking normal again. I think that was also part of the the perception and the hope from so many parents and just people in the community.
Yeah. No, in many cities in the U.S., especially I grew up in Cleveland, the radio didn't play hip hop. You could only hear hip hop. This was like late 80s, early 90s. There was one radio station that played it every Saturday night from like 11 p.m. to like 2 a.m. It was a show called Rapper's Delight. Okay. And like you would record it on a cassette every single week and then listen to it over and over because the radio stations, they were like, no, 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 we're not playing this music. So it was still seen as this kind of underground, like secret with you and your friends. And, you know, So with you, though, you mentioned in some of your other interviews that you did try the different elements, that you do have experience with aerosol art, with rapping and with breakdance, but ultimately it would be DJing that would be kind of what you gravitated to the most and what you're known for.
Yeah.
What was it about DJing that kind of drew you in?
I just love music and I love experimenting as well. And I had to make a choice, you know, because I felt that I was at a decent level with all the other elements as well. But, you know, to become really refined and really skillful to a point for me personally where I wanted to be happy and content with moving forward, you had to choose. Because if you needed to break, you needed to put in the hours, then something else is going to fall behind as well. And I think at a certain point when we were touring as well, it was in 95 when I started slowing down on breaking. I kept on with MC work. And over the last 2 years, people pulled me out of retirement on projects to take the mic again. So that's weird and interesting at the same time. And I think as far as DJing goes, I think just by default, I became the DJ for Prophets of the City. And when we formed BVK, by default, I fell in as the DJ on that end as well, until Azul came in and E came in. And I started assuming other roles within the group. And I just found myself participating in competitions and people booking me and all of those different types of things. And people were more interested in what I was doing as a DJ and a turntablist. And that kind of made me more committed. And as I've mentioned before, if you really want to be good at it, it's gonna require a lot of time out of your life. You're going to have to put in the hours, the months, the days, and the years, you know, to get somewhere within the craft.
Yeah. So looking kind of back in terms of the history part, in terms of when you all first not started listening to it, but actually started practicing hip hop. So you're looking at the early 80s. And I know, you know, when I've kind of talked about hip hop really starting here in the early 80s, you know, there's been people who've kind of doubted, like, was it really that early? And I'm like, no, just because you weren't aware of it, it was happening. But my question is, hip hop first arrives in Cape Town. And crews begin forming. But what is the timeline for other parts of South Africa? Do you know in terms of when hip hop then is spreading to other parts and where other areas are also kind of picking it up and practicing it?
I cannot give you the exact timeline, but I know from some of the research that's been done through the South African Hip Hop Museum, they have pinpointed certain people in different areas and rural areas that were introduced to the music and the culture in the early 80s as well. And I always like to refer to myself because of just the time and the limitations to be able to move, you know, from city to city, place to place and space to space. I wasn't there to see. So my introduction came in 1980, summer of 1980. That was my personal introduction. In 1981, when we relocated to Mitchell's Plain, that's when a friend of mine that came from District 6 as well, the guy that had the video recorder, he introduced me to music that they recorded, the music videos that came on television at the time. So now we're going 81, 82. 83, we formed, late 82, 83, we formed our first B-boy crew called the City Kids, still not knowing that this was hip-hop that we were busy with. And then in 84... we started seeing more crews pop up across Cape Town City because there was competitions being held in nightclubs. And it was very young. You know, there was no guidance. There was nobody to show you how to do a six step. There was nobody to show you how to do an up rock. So you tried to mimic what you could see on TV and the videotapes. And we know the technology at the time, it was extremely delicate as well. So to try and rewind the tape and to play it and to pause, you know, the tapes would get mashed up and eaten up and whatever the case may be. You're in trouble with your parents and all of those types of things. We're breaking records. We're breaking needles on hi-fi players because the things weren't designed for what we wanted to do with it. So, you know, things kind of moved at a different pace, I think, for everybody in all the different cities. But I can tell you with confidence is that the culture blew up as a community in Cape Town before all the other cities.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about one person here, two people there, three people there. No, we're talking about full-blown crews to a point where there were over 20 breaking crews. There were countless amounts of MCs and MC crews popping up, female crews popping up, graph writers all over the place. You know, so hip-hop in its entirety as a culture, Cape Town City, I've got to give credit to the city for that. We only noticed that much later in Joburg. When we moved to Joburg in late 90, after Prophets of the City recorded its first album, by the time that we got into Joburg, there weren't a solid hip-hop community. It was still people in different areas, and maybe there was a crew over here that recorded, somebody over there, but there wasn't like a central space and place where people used to come to and do park jams, and there was like the afternoon jam sessions. All of those things came later to Joburg. Yeah.
Yeah. And Cape Town still to this day has its reputation as being a place for serious hip hop, where all the elements are still very much valued. Whereas, you know, Johannesburg is kind of the commercial capital where you know, the record recording industries and all of that. I did read that you went to the UK in the mid 80s and the article talked about, you know, your return. And I remember, again, being outside of South Africa, seeing a lot of musicians in exile. So we know a lot of people left and, you know, had their careers in exile. So I saw, okay, you went to the UK, you left, and then you went back during apartheid.
Correct.
Was there ever, like, I don't want to ask why did you go back, but I was like, okay, like, what? Yeah.
I went to the UK because there was an opportunity. So that was the first motivator right there. And the person that actually paid for all my costs and the person that whose home I stayed in was one of our fellow B-boys from one of our crew members. And he was a white boy, a DJ Aski. So he moved back to Liverpool in the UK because he didn't want to be conscripted by the army at the time. And that's the reason why he went back. And when he went back, it just so happens that he inherited a whole lot of money. And he noticed my seriousness and my passion, you know, for the culture. And he decided to cover my costs. And I went over there for just over a month. And my mission going there was to learn as much as I possibly could. And that's when I kind of got a sense, you know, of what it looked like to DJ, because I was seeing these guys in front of me cutting it up, mixing. I was checked out b-boying on a much higher level. I started visiting all these pirate radio stations. We started purchasing a lot of music. I recorded a lot of cassettes while he was out gigging and doing his thing. I would stay behind at his house and I would just take the opportunity to record as much music as I possibly could. And at the same time, I was spending time practicing on his decks because I didn't have decent decks at home. So I used every moment, you know, to kind of upskill myself, whether I'm learning something or whether I'm putting time in to spend enough time on decent decks. And by the time that I came back, he sent me back with tons of vinyl and lots of tapes. And when I came, it was almost like the scene got a boost, it almost like it was injected and revitalized and there was a new energy. So I brought the 24-hour jam session concept back as well, because that's what we experienced in the UK. So that's what we kicked off as well. And all of those experiences added on, I think, to the popularity of the culture as well. So that being in the days of apartheid, you know, the minute word gets out on the street that something is happening, you know, people want to be there. People are curious as well. And as kids, we were rebellious. You know, you tried to use whatever excuse or tried to find any way to outsmart the cops and the army just to get to where you needed to be. And that's what happened during that time as well. So I think the move to the UK, let's say the visit to the UK for that brief period, it did a lot for the culture. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, okay. That's, I mean, and it's, I love that response because it was, you weren't thinking of, okay, I'm outside of South Africa, so I could easily, you know, file a claim for asylum and stay out and be, but it was kind of taking everything that you've learned and everything that you had back and that impact. That was
okay. Yeah. And besides, I mean, I'm deeply rooted there. I'm deeply rooted in Cape Town, in South Africa, or here on the continent. And I can't see it happening any other way as well. Plus, my family was here. My mom, she was a single parent. So there's no ways I could leave my mom behind as well. Yeah.
And so kind of fast forwarding, you then started a show on Good Hope FM that you had for several years. And I know I went to one of the events you all sponsored, or I don't know if it was a weekly event where you gave opportunities for younger, newer, upcoming MCs to perform. But the one I went to, you all also did an exhibit teaching people the different scratches and the history of DJ Jazzy Jeff and his scratch he invented. And I thought that was, again, this whole idea of paying it forward and not just, I have this gig, let me make some money, but let me also pour into that next generation. Doing that, working at Good Hope FM and kind of staying connected, how have you seen the development of hip hop in South Africa, specifically in Cape Town? And how do you feel that show and the things that you all did kind of help contribute to hip hop's development?
I think the show on Good Hope FM really impacted the scene and the community in a huge way. It still does, though. Having a music play on a station such as Good Hope FM, because it's regarded as a commercial station, it does a lot for an artist. So the times that we had the cypher sessions run on there, a lot of guys and ladies came out, you know, for their 15-second, 20-second of fame. And it was something that was definitely valued. So it was a two-way street. For me, it was cool to learn about all the new artists coming through the doors and also to see the development and to see the evolution, because different generations started coming through the doors as well. There was a time that I knew everybody in the city. I could tell you exactly who's who, what artist is who, what breaking crew. But working there, I came to realize quickly how hip-hop and the culture has started to grow. A lot of names came through the door. A lot of young kids, young faces came through the door that I didn't know. Youngster CBT was one of those kids that came through the door that I didn't know from a bar of soap. So the show gave me the opportunity to learn about a lot of a lot of big names and a lot of established artists now. And I think a lot of these artists also use the show as a launch pad for their careers as well. So it has always been a two-way street, I would say. It was like a give and take scenario. And I think in South Africa, we still have a great amount of people that listen to radio and that trust radio. And there's a lot of value, I would say, you know, in order of getting your feet in or getting your, through the doors or getting noticed or some type of exposure via those platforms.
And I think it's also, you know, one of the things that I've admired is in doing that, a lot of the times I do think that sometimes hip hop heads of this generation look and criticize younger artists in the direction that they're taking hip hop. And it's like, well, that's not real rap and that's not da, da, da. And, you know, there's a lot of kind of complaining and criticizing. And I think that's why your collaboration with Youngster CBT, I think, is so important, because this is intergenerational collaboration where there's not kind of this established artists just, you know, sitting in critique of younger artists, which really doesn't help. I mean, and so could you kind of talk about how that collaboration came about and like the significance of it?
Is this the collaboration between myself and Youngster?
Yeah.
Okay, awesome. Cool. First and foremost, I've collaborated with many artists, you know, through my career, not just within hip hop, but outside of the boundaries of hip hop music and the culture. I've collaborated with rock musicians. I've played in the classical arena, played in the jazz arena, the experimental jazz arena as well. So just to get back to hip hop, when I was introduced to Youngster first, I immediately noticed something. You know, you can tell, especially if you have X amount of years under your belt and experience within the industry, not just as an artist, but also somebody that can see potential. I've worked within the artist development sort of arena as well. I just knew there was something. And He came through the doors at Good Hope FM as a freestyle MC, and he was dropping mixtapes. I think the first time that I was introduced to him, he'd already had 3 mixtapes under his belt that I wasn't aware of. About a year passed, and he was consistently at the show on a Wednesday. Then I saw him come to the show with 2 managers. And I was like, wow, this freaking kid is serious. And then I think he was on his 7th mixtape already. And I was like, wow, this kid is putting in the work. And I could hear every time he comes back, the lyrics are sounding better. The flows are better. There's just something. And I could tell you're putting in the work. And for me, I was like, this is something that I need to back and I need to support it, because the ethic is right there. The principles are in place in terms of where this kid is going. He's young. He needs to find his way through the lyrics and through the music. But the bottom line is, he's putting in the work. And at such a young age, you know, to be putting out such sophisticated lyrics and bars and thinking about the rhyme structures and the music and all of that, those are all the nuances that I take notice of. And those are all the things that kind of made me, that made me more committed. And then we did an early collaboration during that time as well. It was a song that I put out for a brand. He came through. That was our first collaboration. Grandmaster Eddie D featuring Youngster CPT. And as time progressed, we then ended up doing shows together as well. They put us on this Cape Town Electronic Music Festival show. And there was a good sort of, we gelled very well. So I fell in place as his DJ. And we just started building a much stronger bond. They started doing all of the events. I supported them on the events. Came there, myself, Azul, the Beat Bangers, supporting his events. Because we all seen the work and we all believed, you know, in where this kid could go. And also, his team spent a lot of time with us as well, you know, in our private capacities, just picking our brains, asking for guidance and all of these things. And that's how we knew, no, this is serious and this is going to blow up big time. But they didn't come looking for handouts.
Yeah,
it was more case, you got X amount of experience in the industry. You know, can you please guide us on this? Contracts, how do we read a contract? What do we do? How do we price? We're traveling. What are the things that we need to put in place? The traveling is a sort of event industry type of questions and all of those things. And I think with all of those experiences, kind of tightened the bond right up until recently when we went to New York together. And yeah, there's a lot of interesting things and big things that's looming. And we'll see, you know, how we build from there onwards. Yeah.
Well, that was going to be kind of one of the questions I ended with in terms of what can we expect. Could you lastly, I guess, share your, given your experience, kind of how you see the trajectory of hip hop, specifically in South Africa, but also the art of DJing, which I know has kind of shifted with producers. One of the conversations I had with Azul is the idea that a lot of DJs are also producers, but not all producers have the DJing skills in terms of the turntables. So could you kind of talk about the evolution of the DJ in specifically in South Africa in that kind of art form, but then also like looking at hip hop in general?
Yeah, sure. I think being a DJ within the culture, it's always going to require a set of principles and skills in order for you to truly be recognized. It takes a lot of time, takes a lot of skill to execute it correctly. And you also have to be prepared to be a student for life as well. You know, there's no room for egos to be floating around and also for putting in claims that you are the best. It just doesn't work that way. Art don't give you the luxury of walking around and going through life with an inflated ego. The art form will humble you very quickly if you are serious about it. So being a hip-hop DJ, I think it's very important, you know, to kind of remember that. And also to be, you need to be open-minded as well. You need to appreciate, I would say, the history, the heritage. And if you are able to be more flexible in terms of becoming a producer and learning how social media works and learning how the business end of things sort of function as well, that will be in your interest as well. You know, some of us are very caught up in the passion of being a DJ, MC, or whatever, and we'll just go to any show or jump on any stage because we're passionate. You know, you put in the work, you put in the time and the hours, and you won't even think of charging a fee. So this is where the business comes in, and this is where finding a manager, trustworthy manager or a team comes into play as well, you know, to help you become sustainable if you choose to go down that route. So I think it's an ongoing discussion. It's a much broader discussion. And I think with the way the world is going, it's becoming more challenging as well. So it's got its pros and it's got its cons. And if you're able to tap into the internet and the online platforms, I think that is probably where you're going to succeed. Because the scene, or should I say, outside of DJing as a, or being a hip-hop DJ, the scene is oversaturated. Cape Town City is kind of on its knees at the moment, and there's a huge shortage of professional DJs getting work because clubs, promoters, events, festivals are just latching onto all these kids. And also music has become so much more accessible. You can just jump online and download all the hits and the things that people are into. You don't even have to mix these days. You just play the song and you get booked. So a lot of the core aspects and the artistic elements, and or should I just say the integrity of being a DJ, is getting lost in translation, and it's being disrespected to a huge degree as well. So we need to think about all of those things and think how we are able to preserve it, number one. And also think building international connections and building global communities that still value hip-hop culture at its core. I think that is the key, you know, in order for us all to survive and to be able to exercise and promote and to express ourselves through our art the best, and also to perform to people that will actually appreciate, you know, somebody doing whatever he or she does, whether it's breaking graph or spitting some really good bars or conscious bars or whatever the case may be. I think that's how we're going to have to build it. Then from there, build a bigger fan base out of that as well.
Okay. And lastly, can you talk at all about anything that you've got coming up, any projects? Like what can you share?
Yeah, sure. We do a lot of work in the youth development sector as well. We do have a nonprofit organization. So currently we are busy turning what's been a feeding initiative for youth. We are busy putting all the plans in place to transform that into a self-sustainable youth festival. And we're working with communities and youth that live below the poverty line, and they live outside of central Cape Town City. So they're kind of off the radar of where people will bring in aid, and especially aid coming in from mainstream organizations. So these are communities that's completely, how do you say, it's almost like they are forgotten communities. They're being sidelined. And I understand it. I'm not mad at anybody, but it's just that we've been introduced to those communities. We built relationships over the years, and we're using the culture, you know, and the experiences that we have to see how we are able to create a sustainable future for these kids in these communities.
Lastly, I want to say I do think it's awesome that so many of the pioneers in South Africa are still active. So I know yourself and Emil are still very, very active in not only hip hop, but also kind of working within communities that, yeah, where services aren't necessarily what they should be.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I just want to, you know, say, so thank you for, yeah, taking the time to talk.
Well, good. Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to the Hip Hop African Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, make sure you subscribe. For more interviews, articles, and resources, visit hiphopafrican.com. We'll see you next time. Peace.